Thank you, Margot Adler. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time now for questions from the audience. While the ushers collect them, let me begin by asking this. I'm concerned about the amount of violence that one sees in these vampire novels and films, and how that violence is received by readers. I'm wondering how the presence of the violence interacts with the morality questions and the spiritual quest that you explore in this fiction.
Well, first of all, having now read 260 vampire novels, haven't seen a lot of films, but I've seen most of the television shows, it really runs the gamut, first of all. I mean, there are ones that have very little violence, there are ones that have none, and what I see, at least on television, not always, but what I see sometimes is that there's a one-upmanship of violence year by year because they have to sort of, I mean, this is what you see on HBO. You know, the first year of True Blood was quite lovely and moral and there wasn't that much violence. And then each year, there's been more sex and more violence till it's almost like, you know, over the top. You can't really even deal with it. Other ones like The Vampire Diaries have a lot less violence. There are, I would say that, what's interesting about the violence when it's used well is it's, you know, what do you do when you have a need for blood and humans are the only species, you know? There's a wonderful science fiction short story called Food of All Flesh by Zena Henderson, who's a wonderful science fiction writer. And it's just this incredible short story that someone alerted me to in which this alien species comes down to Earth and there's like no communication and they meet this priest and the priest is trying to give it food and everything it eats, it sort of regurgitates and nothing's right for it. He gives him one thing and one thing of human food and another thing, nothing works at all. And finally her little babies come out, and they're little tiny babies, and one of them goes onto her hand and suddenly bites and sucks a tiny bit and falls right asleep. And the mother, there's a long moment and a long pause of silence, and the mother picks up her little kids and gets back on the spaceship and goes away. And so it's like, you know, it's kind of the moral, she, oh my God, this is what I need, but I'm gonna make this moral decision and I'm gonna get out of here, you know. It's a wonderful, wonderful story. And I just read two recent novels by this wonderful woman named Julie Kagawa. And she really is struggling with this moral question because she has it's a young adult novel, two novels so far out of it. It's going to be at least a third. It's called the Blood of Eden series. And she has a human protagonist in a dystopian world, very Hunger Games-like, except ruled by vampires. And she is forced to choose between death and becoming a vampire. She becomes a vampire, and suddenly she is trying to deal with this hunger, which is overpowering, but yet she's falling in love with a human guy, and she's trying to figure out, can I actually have this relationship, or will I not be able to master my own, you know, will I have the discipline, will I have the ability, or is it too much? So I think it's interesting that it's that struggle, and when they're good, when the movies and things and novels are good, they deal with the struggle more than just, you know, gratuitous violence.
Thank you. If the vampire is the metaphor for the outsider in all of us, what is our societal metaphor for the insider, and how do these balance each other, if they do?
Oh, my. The metaphor for the insider. Probably the Zen master. I don't know. I really don't know. I don't have a clue. I'm not sure I can answer that.
It's an interesting question.
It's
but
very,
yes,
I mean, it's something that you have to speculate for months or something, you know. I'm not sure who is the metaphor for the insider. But I think silence and listening and all that kind of stuff is the metaphor for the insider more than any outward being or person, maybe.
Here's our next question. In addition to vampires, there seems to be a recurring obsession with zombies.
Oh.
How do you see this playing into the vampire narrative or myth, and if so, how?
I have not spent a long time, although I just read the most bizarre book, Princeton University Press, called something like Zombies and International Relations. And the guy is a professor of international relations, and he is using the idea of a zombie attack to explore different theories of international relations. So he's going to use it in his college courses, you know. So, and apparently it is being used, you know. So, you know, there's the kind of neocon view of international relations, and there's the realist view. Anyway, there were four different paradigms, and they actually took, you know, their attitudes toward a zombie attack and what that would be. I mean, I'm fascinated that zombies have sort of taken over, because they're sort of not really sentient unless you have. I did watch that movie that's Romeo and Juliet, Warm Bodies, which actually was sweet, because he's not. I mean, the thing about zombies that doesn't interest me is they're not very sentient. And actually, there are a number of horror novels, vampire horror novels, including some who've been on the bestseller list, like The Passage by Cronin and so forth, where the zombies aren't really very sentient. And to me, that's not interesting. I mean, if you don't have, then how can there be a struggle? How can there be tension if it's just, and even the horror novels like Salem's Lot, which is beautifully written, but, you know, vampires are pure evil. There's just no way, they're just pure evil and you're fighting against them. So I'm much more interested in this place where there are tensions. And in Warm Bodies, in that film, there is a tension between being a zombie and sort of becoming more of a human being. And so that, it's kind of interesting. But a lot of the zombie movies are just kind of a chance to have sort of wasted violence, you know.
Societies and religions have always had metaphors for bad things, for evil. Have we evolved to the point where we can discuss the evils we face without using any metaphors for them? And if so, how?
Oh, so the question is about evil. You know, I mean, I tend to come from the place where evil is about disconnection. You know, I mean, I'm not one of those people who has a sense. I've never really experienced what I would call pure, unadulterated, you know, evil. And so most of what I see as evil in our society are people who are in some way disconnected from human beings, disconnected from the society in some way. That's where evil sort of, it comes from alienation and disconnection. So, you know, I don't know if we, but metaphors are always useful. Give me the question again.
Societies and religions have always had metaphors for bad and evil. I'm presuming the person is making the connection that a vampire is actually a metaphor for evil. So have we evolved to the point where we don't need these kind of metaphors anymore? We can just discuss evil openly without a figure for it, in other words, without a figure
without
for
a
evil.
Without a figure for it. I think we're able to do that, beginning to do that. I don't know, these are heavy-duty questions.
We have a tough audience.
Whoa, these are questions you can't just be flippant with. You have to sort of meditate on them for several, you know, for a long time. I thought I would, some of my funnier questions.
Well, here's a interesting one for you. In all of your research, did you discover any humorous aspects of vampires?
Oh, my heavens. Oh, that's my, actually, I love talking about this. So, I took the 260 novels and divided them by genre, because actually they are in every kind of genre. So they're detective thrillers, there's science fiction, there's alternate history, there's romance, there's what I call vampires at school, there's what I call Hogwarts for vampires, which is basically vampires at vampire school. They're comic novels for adults, and my favorite are what I would call geeky, teen, nerdy vampire novels. Which are, for example, there's a book called Suck It Up by Brian Meehl. And he's 15 when he's turned, so he's going to have acne for eternity, right? There's a wonderful book called Sucks to Be Me with the sequel, Still Sucks to Be Me. And this is a wonderful, wonderful series written by an English teacher, young adult, two books. And what she does is she basically has this girl who is, you know, in high school, and she finds out her parents are vampires, and she has to make a choice when she's 18 to either be one or not, but it's a very complicated choice, because if she decides to, she has to immediately leave, because they're beginning to notice that the parents aren't aging, and she has to leave all her friends behind, and if she decides not to, then she has to leave her parents behind, so she has to make this choice. And when she finally makes the choice and ends up in this other place, it's just as bad. She's a vampire, but she still has to obey her parents. She still has to go to school. Everything is still awful. And there's nothing that's changed in her life in a wonderful way, despite being a vampire. So then there's a whole series of adult comic novels, which some of which are really, really bad, but some of which are fun. You know, you read the first one and you say, okay, I get it, and you don't need the next 12. But there's one called Undead Anne. So Undead and Unwed, Undead and Unemployed, Undead and, you know, right? There's Real Vampires Have Curves, about a supposedly full-figured vampire. I mean, this goes on and on and on. And then there are the masters, like Terry Pratchett in his Discworld series, you know, one of the most, like the second most popular novelist in the UK ever. And he has vampires. He has a wonderful, he has many vampires in his Discworld series. And one of them, which is called Monstrous Regiment, is a book in which all these girls join the army and disguise as men, and it turns out that the entire regiment is really women, but they've disguised as men, and even the vampire is really a girl vampire and not a boy vampire. It gets very, very weird. Anyway, there's a lot of comic stuff, and some of it's actually fairly funny.
Thank you. We have time for just one more question. I have never read a vampire novel or seen a vampire movie. Where would you suggest I start?
Well, it all depends on what kind of literature you like. If you like, one of the books that really intrigues me, although Vampire is one of the characters, is this book which was actually on the bestsellers list last year a little bit. It's called A Discovery of Witches by Deborah Harkness. And she is a professor of, she's a historian of the history of science, the author, at USC, I believe. And so the book, while it has supernatural in it, it also has science and wine blogs, and it's, you know, full of interesting stuff. And it's I think it's a very, very interesting book. There's a book by George R.R. Martin, the same guy who did Game of Thrones, called Fever Dream. It takes place on the Mississippi River in the 19th century. Very interesting, well-written, beautiful novel. In the romance category, the only thing that I really loved was, believe it or not, by Nora Roberts, who I had never read before at all, and at first didn't believe she'd written 260 books or whatever she had. I thought she must be a fraud, but it turns out she writes 8 hours a day or 9 hours a day for the last 30 years, and she writes well. And there's something called the Circle Trilogy. It has a vampire in it. It's not a vampire novel, but it has a vampire in it that's beautifully realized, beautifully done. What else would I recommend? If you want to go for Anne Rice, The Vampire Lestat's very interesting. If you want to go for this presidential thriller thing that I was into, I'd say Jeff Gillenkirk's Pursuit of Darkness. So there are a lot of choices. I have a list of 13 the essay that you sort of heard me read is part of a longer essay that was published as an Amazon single for only $1.99 on Amazon, and it's going to be part of a longer book that's going to come out later. And at the end of that book, I have my baker's dozen of the best ones that, you know, having gone out through 260, here are my favorite 13. So I guess that's it.
Thank you, Margo Adler.
Thank you. You've been great.
You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about our lyceum, you can visit our website at monadnocklyceum.org. The program next Sunday will feature Andrew Bacevich, who will be speaking on Cheap Grace and the American Way of War. And there will also be a short concert of classical mandolin music beginning at 10:30 a.m.